So now we'll have a few minutes of silent meditation. So you can do a body scan and check in with your body. Make sure there's no tension anywhere and relax the tension if you find any. And then go into meditation on the breath. Or if you want to do another contemplation or lumbar meditation for a few minutes, that's fine as well. And let's come back to our motivation. Remember that we're practicing the Dharma and learning it, not only for our own well-being, to make this life better, but to have a long-term goal. And that's quite large, that lasts over many lifetimes and expands the benefit of the Dharma practice to include other living beings, and expands the motivation then to attain full awakening in order to be able to best benefit them. So at the very beginning of the teachings, we really expand our motivation, stretch our mind. And that's a very good way to prepare ourselves to really take in the Dharma. So generate that motivation now. So, here we are, having another week's vacation with the Buddha. Yeah, which is quite fortunate to be able to do. And we're going to be going through the second volume of the Library of Wisdom and Compassion. So, in each volume, just, you know, as I'm in the preface, I try and tell a little bit about the origin of the, you know, of the series, how it came about. But I don't have to read that to you. I can just kind of give you a little summary. Some of you have heard it before. But in my experience in studying the Dharma with Tibetan teachers, it became very obvious that... You know, when Tibetans start studying the Lam Rim, the stages of the path, or the gradual path to awakening, they start based on a belief in the three jewels. They have faith in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha already. They believe in rebirth. You know, they have a whole, you know, kind of worldview already. And we come to it, and we don't have that worldview. Yeah. And then many of the scriptures written by the Tibetan lamas tell stories that illustrate the point that many of us cannot relate to. You know, like, what's the meaning of this story? And you know, so what you find in the West is single volumes that explain the whole path, like as an introductory book. And then you find the translations done by academics of the treatises that are written in quite difficult language to read. Yeah, and then none of them start at the point where we are with questions like, well, what do you mean? What's the mind? You know, let's start with the foundation. We're talking about the mind. What in the world does that mean? Okay. And so I went to His Holiness in the early 90s and asked if he could write a short text that the Tibetan Geshe's could use to teach from when they taught in the West. And he said, oh, yes, but first we have to do the longer version. And he gave me a transcript of some of his teachings and sent me off. And so I started writing and including things that I had heard him say, and also accumulating a list of questions that most of us who, you know, were not raised Buddhist had. And then in subsequent years, was able to go back and have interviews with His Holiness and ask these questions. And at a certain point, then he said he wanted the book to not just be another Lam Rim, but to be something unique and to accumulate, to include the some of the teachings in other Buddhist traditions. And so then I began to learn the Pali tradition and, you know, learn more about the Chinese tradition and so on, which really helped me in my own practice. And then, you know, as years went by, then it became apparent he wanted one volume that talked about the different Buddhist traditions, how they saw some of the chief elements in the Buddha Dharma. So that became the book, Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. Yeah, but having, you know, been writing for many years, there was still 2,000 pages of manuscript after that book was done. And so then I started putting together the Library of Wisdom and Compassion. And we don't know how many volumes it's going to be. It'll be at least 8, we have to see. Yeah, so this is volume 2. Volume 3 comes out in January. Volume 4, I'm giving the first draft of the manuscript to the publisher before I leave in the middle of this month. And volume 5 is, you know, to come, okay? And so are the rest of the volumes. So volume 1 that we were reading from last night is very much an introductory volume, trying to cover some of the material that His Holiness believes it's important for us to know before we start really looking at the path. This volume continues that. And then we start going into some of the traditional layout of the path. But even there, His Holiness gave me permission to reorder things a bit. And so, for example, usually in the traditional layout, the topic of taking refuge, usually, okay, You start with your precious human life, and then, you know, its value and purpose, and then death and impermanence. And then they have a big section on the lower realms and how you could be born as hell beings and hungry ghosts and animals. That section got shortened to a few pages in here. And then it usually goes into a very general description of refuge in the Three Jewels, the idea being that if you have faith in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, then understanding karma becomes much easier because all the details of karma are something that only an enlightened being can know directly. However, teaching in the West, you know, after you talk about the preciousness of our life and the purpose and that we're not going to live forever, then people become very interested in what karma is and, you know, what is a good life? What is the meaning of living a good life, according to the Buddha? And so, and then people also in the West generally find karma, refuge, a much more difficult topic because you're describing the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we're going, how do we know this is true? And, you know, what in the world does this mean? Yeah. And so what I did is after death, you know, the abbreviated section on the lower realms, and then went directly into karma. Yeah, because that's what people are really interested in. And then in volume 3, yeah, actually, refuge doesn't come until volume 4, the volume I'm finishing up right now. Yeah, because in volume 3, we started going into the four truths. Yeah. So, you know, things got modified a little bit, and there's a reason for it, yeah, because putting refuge later makes a lot of sense, because when people know about the four truths, what's often called the four noble truths, then they realize that the last two of those, true cessations and true paths, that's the Dharma refuge. So then it makes sense to talk about the three jewels of refuge, okay? Because you've learned something about the true cessations and true paths. So that's why, you know, refuge comes much later when people, when they're ready to understand things that are not so evident to the senses, okay? But in this volume, you know, we continue with some of the introductory material. That doesn't necessarily mean it's easy material. Okay, introductory does not mean easy, because His Holiness, when He teaches in the West, He would just jump in with some of the most difficult topics, talking about the two truths, the nature of emptiness, the nature of mind, the four truths. I mean, he would go right into fairly complex topics. And he said it was because the audience was educated and, you know, people could think about these things. So I think he was counting on everybody listening with a much more critical, intelligent mind of listening to something, then thinking about it, checking it out. Very often in Asia, the audiences just listen with faith, but not always with a lot of critical thinking. And His Holiness really pushes this thing of using reasoning, just as we saw last night when we were reading, you know, really thinking about things, seeing if they make sense, if there's some kind of reasoning that supports them. So instead of just, well, it feels good, so I believe it, having something to back it up. Yeah. One of my teachers, when he was explaining this, and when we were going through one section of teachings where we were refuting different non-Buddhist views that were popular in India in previous centuries, and we were saying to Geshe-la, you know, why are we studying this? Who in the world would believe this stuff? And Geshe-la said, listen, these people, you know, they have reasons behind it. And if you don't have solid reasons for believing in what you believe, you know, in what the Buddha taught, then if these people came and started teaching you, you'd just believe them too, you know. The idea being that if our conviction in the Dharma is just based on blind faith or the Buddha said so or my teacher said so, then as soon as somebody else says something else, you're going to believe that person. Yeah. So that's why His Holiness really, especially now, is encouraging people to think well about things. Also in this book, there's several chapters, and I hope we get to them, about the student-disciple relationship, which again is a topic of much confusion in the West. And the source of, confusion and more confusion. and so, in the Lam Rim, for people who are going to take tantric initiation, so these are people who have studied for a long time, you know, then they receive a certain teaching on the guru-disciple relationship before they take the tantric initiation. But in many Lam Rim books, that same view is presented at the beginning of the Lam Rim. And then we come to it as newbies, you know, and like, what's a guru and what's a disciple? And then we learn the view that's appropriate for people who are about to enter a very advanced practice. And we learn that view as beginners, and we get totally confused. Yeah. And so a lot of very unfortunate circumstances have happened because of that, different scandals and abuse within the Buddhist community. And so His Holiness at different times has spoken out quite extensively on what the a good way to relate to a spiritual mentor is. And so the chapters in here go into it in depth, and I think it's quite helpful for people who live in a who come from a different culture. Yeah. Oh, I could go off on my soapbox about that. I will restrain myself until we get there. Yes. There, I have a few soapboxes, you know. That's one of them. Yeah, I can't wait until somebody brings in a soapbox here. Okay, so I just wanted to let you know what's coming in this volume. We'll start with the introduction by His Holiness, and then we go into the Buddhist approach. And so this goes through the four seals, four qualities that make something a Buddhist teaching, and the two truths, in other words, how objects exist on the level of appearance and how their deeper mode of existence is, what their deeper mode of existence is. And then we go into gaining non-deceptive knowledge. Yeah, because if we're going to know how things exist, we have to know what are reliable cognizers that, reliable minds that tell us the truth. Because believe it or not, not everything we think accords with reality, you know, and even all of our senses don't necessarily accord with reality. So we have to learn, you know, what consciousnesses are trustworthy to give us what kind of information. So it's a very valuable chapter. It is difficult for, you know, it's not that difficult. Once you get used to it, none of these things are difficult. When you first start them and you're not familiar with the vocabulary and the concepts, it seems difficult. But once you get used to it, it's not so bad. But one of the reasons we made this retreat, one where it's not a silent retreat, you know, and it's more like a course with some meditation sessions, of course, is because we want people to be able to think about these different topics between sessions and to talk about them with each other, you know, after meals and in break times. Yeah. So please take the break times and such to go over and review the material we covered, to read ahead, to write out some of the important points that you've learned, because if you write out the important points, then as we go deeper into the topic, it'll continue to make sense. If you don't write out the important points, you know, and get a little bit of familiarity, then the more you get more unfamiliar words, the more confused you get. Okay, so that's why we left all this time, like, you know, right after lunch and so on, so you can have some study time, so you can read the, it's very helpful, read the text before the class, yeah, because even if you read it, even you don't understand it all, just having read it, it makes it much more familiar when you hear the talk, and then afterwards go through and really, you know, note the important points, okay? And then, of course, discuss them with each other. And, you know, you can ask questions in class or, you know, in the talks. Or what you can do is write out your question and then leave it here. And then I can answer it, hopefully answer it, okay? So then after non-deceptive knowledge, we go into the basis of the self, the body and mind. And so the people who've been following some of the debate teachings on Thursday nights, this will be quite familiar material. So the idea is, you know, we learn what are reliable cognizers. And then chapter 3 tells us, well, what are the objects that we are going to look at? Yeah, and how does Buddhism classify different kind of objects? Then chapter 4 and 5 go into relating to choosing a qualified spiritual mentor and then how to relate to a spiritual mentor in a healthy way that helps you in your practice. Okay, so you'll notice very clearly, I'm getting on my soapbox, that the chapters are not called guru devotion. Okay, that term is forbidden here at the Abbey. Okay, because it is not an accurate translation. Lama Tenpa means, relying or depending on a spiritual teacher or a spiritual mentor. We hear the word tenpa doesn't mean devotion. It means to rely on or depend on. Okay. We hear guru devotion and, you know, guru, okay, well, they must, you know, they look kind of like God, don't they? You know, long white hair, long beard, you know, because we have the idea of Indian sadhus in the mountains, you know, and then devotion. And we think, I surrender to the guru and, you know, I give up everything. And you know, that's just those words, you know, give people the wrong idea. And that's why, I don't know if he's still around, but a few years ago, there was someone, a self-declared guru in California who said he was the incarnation of Maitreya Buddha. And lots of people followed him and they gave him, you know, their bank accounts. because that's devotion to your guru. You sacrifice everything. First, your bank account. Everything else comes after that. You know? And this is not the meaning in Buddhism of how to rely on a spiritual mentor. Okay? So I think having an accurate translation is helpful to start with. Okay. Then chapter 6 is how to structure a meditation session. So again, very valuable to understand this. Otherwise, you know, we sit down to meditate and it's like, okay, what do I do? And then you turn on your app. Yeah, and you have some guy who, you know, is teaching mindfulness, who has practiced for, you know, maybe a month or two, and, you know, put out this app for $99.99 special price for you, and, you know, and that's what you do. So I think this chapter on how to structure meditation practice and what you learn here, you know, what you are learning here in the morning and evening meditations and in the, you know, it's very important because you'll learn here how to set up a meditation practice, how to do it. You'll have guided instruction. And then when you go home, you just continue to do what you've been doing here. Yeah, you don't change everything. Do one thing when you're at the Abbey and another practice at home. You might have to shorten things a bit, you know, depending on what's happening in your life. But you continue the same practice. So this gives you a very good opportunity to start doing something regularly, you know, with guided instruction. After that, then we go into a chapter on the mind and body and rebirth. So it's a topic that was in volume 1. It's coming up here, going more in depth, because this is something very important to understand in Buddhism, because we're always talking about the mind. And we think, when in the West, when we hear mind, we think brain. And mind and brain are very different. Okay, brain is some gray stuff stuffed in here. You know, mind is that experiential cognitive part of us. Yeah, the one that feels and thinks and experiences. Yeah, and it's not something physical that you can point to. Then we go into the essence of a meaningful life. And then looking beyond this life, and then we'll start talking about death, including how to prepare for death, how to help other people when they're dying. And then we have 3 chapters about karma, you know, which is cause and effect, you know, our actions and the effect of our actions. Okay. We're not going to finish the whole book in 1 week, okay? Yeah, we'll see how far we go, and then we'll continue next year and the year after and so on. Okay, so here's the introduction from His Holiness. So he starts out with 3 aspects of Buddhism's contributions, and he talks about this a lot in different talks. Over the centuries, Buddhism has made a powerful and valuable contribution to our human culture. When speaking of the contribution of the Nalanda tradition in particular, I place its contents in 3 categories: Buddhist science, philosophy, and religion. So the Nalanda tradition is based on all of the very large monastic Buddhist universities that existed in India, starting maybe around 4th, 5th century, and then going until the beginning of the 12th century when Buddhism was virtually wiped out in India. And so these were large monasteries that were also places of study. They were like universities. They had mostly Buddhists, but they also had non-Buddhists, because it was a very vibrant culture in classical India. And all these different schools were debating different tenets, different beliefs, you know, and just having a lot of discussion about what is reality. And so the Nalanda was one place where they went. Odantapuri, Vikramasila, Taxila, you know, many of, there were other places as well. Okay. But the Nalanda tradition based on, you know, Nalanda University and including what they happened at those other monastic universities, that was the one that really spread into Tibet. As well as the tantric tradition, the yogic tradition. So His Holiness, you know, really wants to tie Tibetan Buddhism to India. So he really, you know, the Tibetans actually have done that all along mostly. So he says that Tibetan Buddhism is a continuation of the Nalanda tradition. Yeah, sometime if you go to India and do pilgrimage, you can go to Nalanda and see the ruins of that very incredible place. So, okay, so the three categories of Nalanda's contribution to human knowledge: Buddhist science, philosophy, and religion. So Buddhist science includes discussion of the nature of the external world and the subject, the mind that cognizes it, as well as how the mind engages its objects through sensory and mental cognizers and through conceptual and non-conceptual consciousnesses. Buddhist science also discusses how the mind engages with objects by employing reasoning that helps establish facts about the world. Okay. So Buddhist science also goes into the ancient Indian view of the structure of the universe. Yeah, so Vasubandhu writes a lot about that in his book, The Abhidharma Kosha. So the world is flat, there is a central mountain, there are four continents around it. We live in the southern continent and our sky is blue because it faces the side of the central mountain that has blue jewels on it. that's not what's coming in this book. Okay. But this is a very good example of His Holiness's emphasis on using reliable cognizers and reasoning and so forth. So, you know, when I first started Buddhism back in the 70s, so almost all of the Tibetans believed that the world was flat, and they believed in this because it was said in the Buddhist scripture. His Holiness, knowing some English and being very curious about the world, soon learned the scientific viewpoint and how they proved that, you know, contrary to the old view, that the sun and moon revolved around the earth, that the earth actually revolved around the sun and the moon revolved around the earth. And he learned the correct distances between the earth and the sun and the moon and all. And so he saw what, you know, Vasubandhu, who he still respects very highly, and everybody does, how what Vasubandhu wrote, we don't need to take literally. So this was quite a shock to many in the Tibetan community. One of my teachers, who I treasure so much, he taught me so much for many years, when I was studying with him in France, you know, he believed that the earth was flat. And he was saying, you know, so many paksa, that's their unit of distance, a measurement, so many paksa beneath the Bodh Gaya, you would find the hell realms, you know, because Vasubandhu described all of this. So one of the nuns went and calculated, you know, the number of paksa into kilometers, and then brought a globe to show Geshe La and said, actually, you know, the world is round like this, And that number of Pakse below, if you put Bodh Gaya here and you go straight down, you wind up in California. So that's where the hell realm is. Okay. So it actually, you know, His Holiness still talks about this in the Tibetan community and really emphasizes the point of how we have to apply intelligence and modern knowledge to the Buddha Dharma, because we're looking for the truth. We're not just looking to support a system. We're looking for the truth. Okay, so he starts with that. Yeah. And yeah, it's taken some work on his part. And it's taken also, you know what has helped? Is when some lamas have flown to, you know, like Europe or somewhere, or the U.S., and then they talk on the phone to their friends back in India, and, oh, it's light here, but it's dark there. Oh, you know, maybe the earth is round in the scientific view, and their explanation holds. Yeah, because if the earth is flat, very difficult to say why it's light in one continent and dark in the other. Okay. So then the second one, Buddhist philosophy, includes discussion about the conventional and ultimate modes of existence of persons and phenomena, the four seals indicating a philosophy as Buddhist, the two truths, and emptiness and dependent arising. Okay, so the philosophy is the whole philosophical background. Okay. I also should come into just going back to the Buddhist science and the difference with Western science. And relating that to the comment from the teachings last night is, you know, I would go in and, you know, my teachers would teach Buddhist cosmology as Vasubandhu taught it. And, you know, I didn't agree, but I didn't get angry about it. It's just, okay, Geshe-la believes that. I believe something else. That doesn't mean Geshe-la is stupid, you know. I mean, what he's teaching me in terms of Buddhist philosophy and practice is outstanding, and I couldn't find a better teacher anywhere. So the fact that he doesn't understand astronomy does not bother me. Yeah. I didn't come here to learn astronomy. I can go somewhere else to learn that, okay? So, you know, you just, you can have different ideas about certain things than your teachers, yeah? Buddhist religion describes the path, the basis path and result of spiritual practice, and emphasizes its liberating aspirations and goals. Buddhist religion relies on understanding Buddhist science and philosophy in the sense that they provide the foundation and essential elements for the path to fulfill the spiritual aims of liberation and full awakening. Based on the assumption that every living being has the potential to become fully awakened, Buddhist religion stresses the path of mental development and transformation to attain these supramundane states. Okay, so His Holiness often says, in fact, it may come ahead in here, he wants to share Buddhist science and Buddhist philosophy with the world, because he said, and Indian philosophy in general, even if it's non-Buddhist, because he said it contributes to world culture, and people who are not Buddhist can learn something from it. But when it comes to Buddhist religion, he says that's our business, meaning that he's not trying to convert the world. Since we live in a multicultural, multi-religious world, one of my aims is to present ethical conduct and compassion in a secular way, free of reliance on specific religious doctrine, so that people of all faiths and of no faith can benefit. I also wish to give society access to the intellectual treasures in India's ancient texts and ensure that they are preserved in the body of world knowledge. In this light, I ask some of my foremost students who are scholars in their own rights to form compendiums of the important points of Buddhist science and philosophy and translate them into a variety of languages. The series of these compendiums is entitled Science and Philosophy in the Indian Buddhist Classics and is published by Wisdom Publication. So I know that two volumes about Buddhist science have come out so far. Okay, I'm not sure about the rest. Buddhist science and philosophy can be studied by all. However, Buddhist religion is for Buddhists and those interested in it. We respect each individual's choice regarding religion. The Library of Wisdom and Compassion deals with the spiritual and religious perspective of Buddhism's contribution in the world. It is for those who are interested in learning and practicing the paths that free us from dukkha, dukkha meaning the unsatisfactory conditions of cyclic existence, or samsara. So for people interested in learning and practicing the path that frees us from dukkha and enables us to actualize our full human potential. In this library, you will find Buddhist science and philosophy presented as the basis and means for practicing the liberating path. You will learn how to engage with this liberating knowledge in a personal, transformative way. So there he's saying it, what he's trying to do, and what hopefully we're on board with the same motivation. Okay. Then he goes into a good attitude towards learning the Dharma. Okay. So this is a good and important section, you know, so that we have a right attitude. Buddhist texts contain wise advice on how to approach learning the Buddhist teachings and explaining them to others. Since in this volume we will establish the foundations for Buddhist practice, it is especially helpful to touch on these now. Reflecting on the value of learning the Dharma in my own life, so this is when we use the word I, it refers to His Holiness unless otherwise noticed, you know, I recall some verses in the Jataka tales. So hearing or learning, and I must say very often we talk about hearing the teachings or the wisdom arisen from hearing. That's because in ancient times, it was an oral tradition. It wasn't a written tradition. Yeah, so it was over the centuries. It didn't become a written tradition for like 400 or 500 years after the Buddha, although perhaps some people wrote texts down before that and kept them privately. So we often talk about hearing, but hearing means studying, learning, reading, any way of, learning the Dharma. Okay, so here's this verse from the Jataka tales. Hearing or learning is a lamp that dispels the darkness of afflictions, the supreme wealth that cannot be carried off by thieves, a weapon that vanquishes the foe of confusion. It is the best of friends, revealing personal instructions, the techniques of method. It is the friend. Okay, so learning the Dharma is the friend who does not desert you in times of need. It's a soothing medicine for the illness of sorrow. It's the supreme battalion to vanquish the troops of great misdeeds. It is the best fame, glory, and treasure. So what's really nice about those verses is it's taking common mundane things that people want and showing that actually knowledge of the Buddha Dharma is much supreme to them. Okay, so it can't be carried off by thieves. Yeah. So wherever you are, you know, whether you lock your house or not, if you've learned the Dharma, you have that knowledge inside you. People can rob your house, but they can't take away this knowledge. And that's really important because we never know what situation we're going to find ourselves in. It's a weapon. So, you know, if you're really for having weapons, you know, then the best weapon is the knowledge of the Dharma, because it will confront the foe of your confusion. Okay, we don't need regular other kind of weapons. It's the best friends, you know, because it really teaches you something useful and it doesn't desert you in times of need. Ordinary friends, come, go, go. You know, our Dharma knowledge is always there, no matter what situation we're in. It's a medicine for the illness of sorrow. So when you're sick, either physically or mentally, turn to the Dharma and find the solution to your problem. It's the battalion to vanquish the troops of great misdeeds. So we don't need to send an additional, 12,000? 15,000 troops to the border to turn children away from, because they're a threat to the country. But rather we need to use the Dharma teachings to overcome our great misdeeds. Okay. And then it's the best fame, glory, and treasure. You know, so ordinary fame, glory, and treasure, come, go, go. You have it this life, next life, it's gone. And even it doesn't last all this life. You know, we've seen so many people, you know, have fame, glory, and treasure. Then the stock market, you know, plunges. They get exposed for sexual assault. Who knows? You know, some famous movie star just got arrested for slugging somebody over in a fight over a parking space. So, you know, ordinary fame and reputation and stuff, it's not really worth much. But, you know, if you practice the Dharma, then my goodness, you don't need that external affirmation of being a good person, you know, because you have that in your heart already, you know, and other people will notice it. But when you have that kind of Dharma wisdom, you don't care beans whether other people notice it or not, because that's not what you're looking for, yeah, in life. Due to the problems concerning Tibet's sovereignty that occurred during my youth, I had to accept the request of the Tibetan people and assume leadership of the Tibetan government. I was a mere teenager at the time, with little to no experience of my new duties and responsibilities that concerned the well-being of millions of people. Although anxiety was always beckoning, the Buddha's teachings gave me inner strength. They were the lamp that dispels the darkness of afflictions. So here, His Holiness is giving personal testament to the value of the verses in the Jataka Tales. Okay, so he was 15 years old when the Tibetans told him he had to assume responsibility of the Tibetan government, because there were all these problems between his regents and a lot of going on. And can you imagine, you know, taking control? Imagine what you were like at age 15, okay? And then you were responsible to head a government? Yeah. I mean, what a joke. I mean, could take an American teenager. What a joke to put that. Although, okay, you got my meaning. yeah, but this is, you know, what His Holiness was faced with in his life. So what did he turn to? For, you know, as his companion, as his refuge in all of this. He turned to the Dharma. Yeah. When I had to suddenly flee to India in March 1959 and leave almost all possessions behind and go forward to an unknown future, the Dharma was the friend who did not desert me in times of need. You know, so there he was, 1959, he was 24 years old. Okay, so remember what you were doing at age 24. Yeah. And you're the leader of the government, and your country is being a true invasion, you know, by the communist Chinese. And your life is being threatened such that you have to leave immediately in the middle of the night and cross the Himalaya Mountains in March when it's still cold and tons of snow and glaciers and the whole thing, and wind up in India, totally different climate, different culture, different language. You don't know anybody. Tens and thousands of your people who are relying on you to guide them are crossing the mountains in such dire conditions, going into India, yeah, from the highest place in the world where they have few bacteria and viruses, into the India heat that is filled with bacteria and viruses. And there they go. And His Holiness had to leave like that. It wasn't like, okay, I'm going to take the airplane in a couple of months, and so let's book the tickets, and then we have time to practice and clean things up. No, he was invited to a Chinese opera in Lhasa, and they told him to come alone without anybody else. And this was a time when the Chinese troops were coming into Lhasa. Is that a safe situation for the leader of a country to do? No. So, you know, he rode on the back of a yak. Yeah, he had to dress as a layperson, take off his robes, sat on a yak, you know, and cross the Himalayas. And many of the Tibetans who followed him, they didn't have yaks to ride. They walked, you know. And there's no, nice paved roads going over the Himalaya glaciers, okay? And they wound up in India. And Nehru, you know, bless his heart, was very compassionate and welcomed them and gave them land. Of course, the land that they got in South India, where they reestablished some of the big Gelu monasteries, was jungle. So in the first years, the monks had to spend time clearing the jungle. Yeah, with the lions and tigers and bears, ho ho. Real ones, yeah. And then they had to plant crops, because it wasn't like old Tibet where they received donations. They were in India now, in a Hindu country with a huge Muslim population, and they didn't even speak the language. Yeah, so they had to plant crops and grow crops. So for many years, you know, the monks would have morning meditation, go work in the fields, do some study and memorization, evening chanting, and that was their life. Yeah, and many died in India. At first, when they first came over, they were put in Buxa, which was the old British POW camp. You remember, if you saw 7 Years in Tibet, you know, the one with Brad Pitt or whoever that guy was. So, you know, that was the British POW camp that he was in, and they had closed it after the war. That was where the Tibetan monastics first went, and that's where they lived, in a POW camp. Many of them died there. The lay people, many of them came and they were sent to work on roads. Yeah. So they were still wearing their very heavy yak skin, sheepskin clothes that they had to wear in Tibet cold in the Indian heat because they didn't have any other clothes. And they're working on the roads. And working on the roads is not then in India, is not like now in our countries. You know, it still is sometimes. You have a big concrete mixer there and you put the rocks in it, you put stuff and it goes round and round. And then you take it out in a tray on your head and then you walk somewhere and dump it somewhere. That's how you build a road. You know, after, of course, you've put all the stones and gravel that you've also carried on your head, to lay down. So not an easy life. Yeah. You know, we look at His Holiness now and he's this happy, psychologically, you know, balanced person who doesn't complain. And you look at what he went through in his life. And it's like, okay, this is the proof that the Dharma works. Because if I were to go through that in my life, how would I act? Yeah. You know, if suddenly, you know, tonight we got word and we had to pick up and move to Mexico. Yeah. Are you ready to do that? You're like, oh, but wait a minute, I have to take my computer and my photo albums and my this and my that. And I, you know, I'm not ready. You know, can we go later? No, you got to go now. Okay. So, yeah. So just His Holiness's lives and the lives of, my teachers who were the generation who had to flee, it really shows that the Dharma works when you practice it. Yeah, these are happy people, you know. They aren't like, oh, you know. One time we took Geshe Jampa Tekcho to Airway Heights prison. And you were there. Who else went on that visit? Yeah. So Geshe-la was, you know, spent the first part of his talk telling the inmates how lucky they were to have three meals and a bed and a place to stay where they could practice the Dharma. Yeah? These are guys in prison who think day and night, oh, nobody understands me. I got sent here and it was somebody else's fault. And how am I going to get out? And society's unfair and I can't stand it here. And I can't wait to be free. And Geshe-la is telling them, you have such a good environment for Dharma practice. You know, and then he went in and started telling them, you know, these Tibetan monks who got arrested and thrown into prison, you know, they just meditated and did their practices. They recited scriptures. You know, they couldn't do it out loud because the police would beat them. But, you know, he said, you have, and he was saying, you know, they had a famine there. And it was true that it was a horrible famine because of Mao's great leap forward, which was a great leap backward. And I'm wondering, gee, I wonder how these guys are taking this, you know, being told they're so lucky. And you know, I spoke to some of them afterwards, and they said, yeah, I really saw what he was saying. Yeah. Yeah. So then think about us on the outside, you know, of the razor wire and how fortunate we are. Seeing the, all this, His Holiness is saying, all the scriptures and sutras I had memorized throughout the years came with me to India, providing guidance whenever I needed it. As I lived in exile and watched my homeland and its traditions, culture, and temples be destroyed, the Dharma was a soothing medicine for the illness of sorrow, giving me optimism and courage. In exile, the Buddha's teachings have been the best fame, glory, and treasure because they are always valuable in life and in death. Seeing the benefits of learning the Buddha's teachings, we want to listen to and study them in an effective manner without the defects of the three faulty vessels. If we don't pay it, and then he's going to talk about these three faulty vessels, so check if you're any or all of them. I don't want to make presumptions. Okay. If we don't pay attention while at teachings or when reading Dharma books, if we don't learn, we don't learn anything. Like an upside down pot, nothing can go in. That's the first vessel. Yeah, our mind is upside down. We don't pay attention. We don't focus on what we're reading. We can't remember anything. Okay. If we don't review what we have heard or read, or make our understanding firm, we will forget the teachings, becoming like a leaky pot that can't retain the precious nectar poured into it. So you might have a good pot that's turned upside, right side up, so you hear the Dharma, you know, you understand it when it goes in, but then you don't review it, and so, you know, you can't remember it, you know, a week later or a month later. So it's like all the water, you know, leaking out of a pot with a hole in the bottom. Then, this is a big one, if we are close-minded, opinionated, or have the wrong motivation for learning the Dharma, we become like a filthy pot. Pure nectar may be poured inside and stay there, but because it is mixed with the filth in the pot, it cannot serve its purpose to nourish us. So if we're listening to the teachings with the motivation of, I'll learn these teachings, then I can go back to my computer, then I can go back to my community and become a teacher, and then, you know, I'll just repeat whatever I learn here, there, to those people, and then they'll give me offerings, and I'll become a famous teacher. You know, that's like having a nice pot, but with garbage in it. So you hear the teachings, but our wrong motivation just, you know, and the teachings stay in, but they don't nourish us because our motivation is all wrong. Or if we're very opinionated and like, you know, I believe this and don't tell me anything else because, you know, it's like this, then again, you know, the nectar of the Dharma can't nourish us because it's mixed in with all our wrong views. And we see this sometimes, you know. People nowadays, there's this whole movement towards secular Buddhism, you know. So they want to remove all the items of, you know, of myth from Buddhism. So they start with saying, well, the Buddha didn't teach rebirth, which is ridiculous to say because it's very clear in the sutras that he did teach rebirth. Okay. And so, you know, kind of having, well, it's a polluted motivation and being very opinionated, holding on to wrong ideas, and then mixing your own personal ideas with the Dharma. Yeah. So that then you make the Dharma really comfortable. Yeah. So you can have samsara and nirvana at the same time, because all the teachings that are uncomfortable, you just say the Buddha didn't teach them, or you leave them out, or whatever. Okay. Now somebody's going to say, well, but didn't you say you shortened the sections on the hell realms? Aren't you leaving something out? They're left in. But the Buddha, in the scriptures, yeah, I don't think the Buddha emphasized the hell realms as much as the Lamrim emphasizes them. And also as a way to make the teachings more available to people in the West who already think about Christian hells and bring the idea of Christian hells into Buddhism and then get frightened, you know, then it's better, let's just abbreviate this and, you know, instead of the carrot and the, you know, the stick, instead of using the stick, let's use the carrot to get people interested and get them practicing. Okay. Yeah, people get very confused. One of my friends was telling me that somebody came to him once and said, I was a Christian, but now I'm trying to be a Buddhist, but I'm afraid if I believe in Buddhism, I'll go to Christian hell, but if I go back to being a Christian, then I'll go to Buddhist hell. You know? And it's like, yeah, unnecessary suffering to think like that. You know, there's not Buddhist hell and Christian hell. And what's much more important is the way you live your life. Okay. And Christian hell may last forever. Buddhist hell is only temporary. Yeah. The karma finishes, then you go on to another rebirth. Christian hell is a punishment. Buddhist hell is not a punishment. It's just a result of our actions. Okay. So quite different ideas. Yeah. Okay. With this in mind, please set a wholesome, altruistic intention when reading this book. Aspire, may I read, reflect, and meditate on the Buddha's teachings so that I can become a kind, compassionate, and wise person. Through this, may I be of benefit to all living beings, and in the long term, may I become a fully awakened Buddha. So that's the introduction. Yeah, now we'll do chapter one, which is called The Buddhist Approach. So first is the topic of the four seals. The issue of distinguishing Buddhists from non-Buddhists existed in olden times as it does now. In ancient India, this was usually done on the basis of philosophical views regarding the nature of the self and phenomena. A convenient and concise way to delineate Buddhist views is according to the four seals as found in the King of Concentration Sutra. People accepting the four seals are considered Buddhist by view. Thank you. And those accepting the three jewels as their ultimate source of refuge are considered Buddhist by conduct. Okay? So two ways to be a Buddhist. One is by view, meaning your philosophical views, what you accept, such as the four seals. And then the second is being Buddhist by conduct, which is accepting the three jewels as our ultimate source of refuge, and thereby beginning to live according to an understanding of karma and its effects. Okay. The four seals are, first, all conditioned phenomena are transient or impermanent. Two, all polluted phenomena are dukkha or unsatisfactory in nature. Dukkha is often translated as suffering, but it doesn't just mean suffering. It means unsatisfactory conditions. Yeah. Three is all phenomena are empty and selfless. And four is nirvana is true peace. Okay, so now His Holiness is going to explain those. So first, all conditioned phenomena are transient or impermanent. Conditioned phenomena are products of causes and conditions. Yeah, so this is a basic thing that, you know, you're going to start learning. If we talk about compounded phenomena, conditioned phenomena, impermanent phenomena, all those terms are referring to things that come into being depending on causes and conditions. So the idea of things being dependent on other factors is the basis of all of the Buddhist philosophy. Yeah. So somebody once asked His Holiness if Buddhism had a concise phrase that represented it. And His Holiness said, dependent arising. Okay. So the whole idea is that everything that exists, you, me, everything around us, exists by depending on factors that are not it. Okay? So in terms of causes and conditions, you know, our life depends on causes and conditions, but those causes and conditions are not our life. They are not us. There's something else, like the sperm and egg of our parents, the previous continuity of our mind, and so forth, you know. So things exist dependent on things that are not them. And this comes up again and again, because if things are dependent on other phenomena, then they cannot have their own unique essence that exists from their own side, from its own side. Yeah. So, and this is the key thing in developing wisdom, is to realize that emptiness of independent existence. And of course, understanding dependent existence is one way to do it, because independent and dependent are completely opposite. So the more you understand dependent existence, the more you're going to understand that independent existence is just not feasible. Okay? So the first thing, if you know, and then also understanding that things depend on causes and conditions, and all those conditioned phenomena are transient, that also is an inroad into understanding karma. Because karma, or actions, refers to, you know, our actions which become causes for the results that we experience later on in this life or in future lives. So again, the whole idea of causality as it functions, not just in the physical world, but in the spiritual or religious world, it's better to say in the ethical world, you know, that our ethical choices influence what we experience. Yeah, they create the causes for our experience. So this first thing of the four seals, that, you know, all conditioned phenomena are transient, it means that they all arise dependent on causes and conditions. So they can't be, you know, independent. It, you know, leads us to understand karma. And it also leads us to understand impermanence, because anything that's produced by causes and conditions, you know, cannot last, because when the causal energy ceases, the resultant energy ceases. And as science will tell us too, everything is changing in each shortest moment like this. And there's no way to make things stop changing. Yeah. So for those of us who are seeking some permanent security, you know, so that we have guaranteed financial security, guaranteed emotional security, guaranteed international security, so that the things we have will not disappear and will not change. If we're seeking that, it's a prescription, and we're attached to that, it's a prescription for unhappiness and anxiety. Because things, by their very nature, do not endure in a second moment. And there's no way to make them stop changing moment by moment. Yeah? So, you know, this is already telling us from the get-go, okay, we need a very serious change in our mind to accord with reality, you know, because we're really holding on to a vision of life that it's impossible to have. Yeah. So whatever our age is right now, you know, when we look in the mirror, we think, okay, I'm always going to be like this. Yeah. Especially when you're young, you think that. Just you wait. Yeah. And they say that if you were to look in the mirror when you were 20 and then look in the mirror when you're 60 or 80 or 100, you wouldn't recognize the person that you see. Yeah. But we don't see ourselves as changing like that at all. Yeah. We see ourselves as just kind of fixed and, you know. Yeah. Are the body falling apart? That happens to old people. And your definition of old changes each decade, you know. Whenever your age has a new zero on it at the end, your definition of old changes. Yeah. I remember so clearly, you know, being in my 20s, and we had one friend who was 40, you know, and it was like she was so old. Yeah. And now it's like 40, they're kids, you know. Yeah, they just wait till life pushes them around. They'll learn something, you know, then they'll grow up. Yeah, you know, so, you know, your definition of old changes all the time. Okay, so conditioned phenomena are products of causes and conditions, and all of them undergo change, disintegrating from what they were and becoming something new. So sometimes the new thing they become is a continuum of the past thing, and it's a noticeable continuum. So one moment of this tablecloth produces the next moment. They aren't the same, you know, but they look alike superficially. But, you know, even on a subatomic level, the scientists would tell us, all the electrons are zooming around and they're all in different places from moment to moment. Okay. So just because something looks kind of the same in the next moment doesn't mean it's permanent. It just means the change was small and we didn't notice it, but there was change. Change occurs in coarse and subtle ways. Coarse change occurs when the continuum of something ceases. Subtle change occurs moment by moment. It's the things not remaining the same from one instant to the next. Okay. Let's just read. We won't finish this section, but we'll just read a little bit more so that you can think about this in the meditation session that's coming. We can observe course and permanence with our senses. We see that after coming into being, things later cease. A chair breaks, a person dies, bottles are recycled. Understanding course transience is not difficult. We don't need logical arguments to accept this course level of change. We can see it. Okay? However, for something to arise and cease in this obvious way, there must be a subtler practice of change occurring moment to moment. Without a seed changing moment by moment, a sprout will not appear. Without the sprout growing in each moment, the plant won't come into being. But we don't see these momentary changes, do we? Although sometimes in spring, the knapweed grows so fast that, you know, you almost think you could see those subtle changes, but you still can't. Without the sprout growing in each moment, the plant won't come into being. Without the plant aging and disintegrating moment by moment, it won't die. Without subtle momentary change, course change will not occur. The fact that things end indicates they change subtly in each instant. They are transient or impermanent. In Buddhism, impermanent means changing by moment by moment by moment. It doesn't mean not being eternal, you know. So being permanent and being eternal in Buddhism are not the same meaning. Okay, eternal means that its continuum is never going to cease. Permanent means it does not change moment by moment, but the continuum could cease at some point. Okay, so that gives you the three vessels to think about, these two kinds of impermanence to think about, and whatever else you heard in the talk that really, you know, struck you as something important in your life, then in the upcoming meditation session, please contemplate that, okay, and relate it to your life.